I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we will continue to follow your case. Independent journalist Georgia Fort speaking to us from Minneapolis. She and former CNN host Don Lemon arrested last week for covering a protest inside a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as a pastor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets this weekend as nationwide protests continue against Trump's immigration crackdown and escalating militarization. More than 300 anti-ICE protests were held across the United States Friday, including in Minneapolis, New York, Washington, D.C., Tucson, and dozens of other cities. Thousands of others also participated in nationwide general strike Friday. Democracy Now! Is in the streets of Minneapolis Friday, speaking with protesters who marched in sub-zero temperatures.
My name is Robert Blair Dondelay. I'm the director of engagement and advancement at Film North and also the creative director at the Idealist Project. First and foremost, I'm out here to show that, well, we're not going to accept it, right? These are our family, our friends, our neighbors, our brothers, our sisters. We have children. This country itself, as well as the state, is largely built by migrants and immigrant populations, and we're not willing to accept what's happening to all of our friends.
I'm Andy. I live in St. Paul, and we are here marching on the streets because we need ICE to get out of our community. They've been terrorizing innocent observers and bystanders. They've been stealing neighbors out of their workplaces, homes, schools, and we need ICE out of our community right now. The whole city's been affected. Workplaces have been closed down. I have friends that are scared to go get groceries. I have people who are scared to show up for work. So yeah, I've been affected. This whole city has been affected.
ICE off our streets! No justice, no peace! ICE off our
streets! I'm Izzy. I've grown up in Minnesota, and I'm an aspiring teacher. And I think that right now in this divide, our country lacks empathy, and I think we need to teach peace. We need to stand up for our human rights and protect our students and teach what's right. With the current events, students are feeling less and less safe, and not only is that impacting their education, but their mental, physical well-being. I think that if you can't feel safe in your own home, in your own country, how are you supposed to feel safe in a school?
My name's Ryan. This is a protest demanding that ICE gets out of Minneapolis immediately. I mean, they came here to terrorize us, and they came here to suspend our constitutional rights. It's a lot of anxiety, to say the least, and I'm not one of the people they're targeting, but I still feel it. They need to leave our city now. Illegal paramilitary police forces have no place in Minneapolis or in America. I think they're going to leave because they're going to have to leave. Because no one is going to, this is going to be relentless. It's time for them to go. And I think people need to realize that they came here not for a law enforcement action, but to terrorize our city, our citizens, and our immigrant neighbors. And it's time for them to go.
No fear! Immigrants are welcome here.
My name's Noelle. I've lived in Minneapolis for my whole life, and I'm just deeply concerned and afraid. But I also really feel empowered by the way that Minneapolis residents, by the way that neighbors have come together to support each other. My brother is a student at South High School, and one of his former soccer teammates, who's 16 years old, was detained by ICE along with his sister. So I know that really touched the South community, really hit close to home for us.
Gianna, I was born and raised in Minneapolis. I'm currently a resident. My sign here, Renee, Alex, you. Renee, you know, Alex, they were standing up for what was right. They were looking out for their neighbors. And so really, it's just who's next, you know, at this point. I feel like it's not an if, it's a when. So just really kind of realizing the danger that we're facing here, you know, it affects everybody. No matter the color, the citizenship status, it's really heartbreaking.
Welcome here, no hate, no fear. Immigrants are welcome.
I'm Crystal, and I am from the Leech Lake of Ojibwe Reservation here in Minnesota. My family has been here ever since we migrated to this space. in Minnesota. My sign says ice out. So I'm here today for my two beautiful grandbabies so that their future, you know, is bright and opportunistic and not a, a land where they have to be afraid to be themselves.
My name's Alicia. This is my sister Claire, and we're here to protest for calling for a general strike, and also to tell ICE to get the hell out of our city. I saw them at 26th and 27th in Nicollet last weekend. My sister and I went there to pay our respects right shortly after the shooting and to see if anybody needed help.
She ended up turning into a regular Florence Nightingale. She was there washing tear gas out of people's eyes, and we helped somebody who had passed out. It was really pretty intense. So, that's why we're here. This is totally ridiculous.
Yeah, they have to leave. They have to leave. They have to get out of here. They're terrorizing our neighborhoods and our communities, and it's just not right. It's not right.
Voices from Friday's anti-ICE protest in Minneapolis, one of hundreds of protests that took place across the country this weekend. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s John Hamilton in Minneapolis. Coming up, we look at the newly released Jeffrey Epstein files and the DOJ's decision to keep withholding over 2.5 million more files. Stay with us.
Through the winter's ice and cold, down Nicollet Avenue, a city aflame fought fire and ice 'neath an occupier's boots. King Trump's private army from the DHS, guns belted to their coats, came to Minneapolis to enforce the law, or so their story goes. Against smoke and rubber bullets, in the dawn's early light, citizens stood for justice, their voices ringing through the night. And there were bloody footprints where mercy should have stood, dead left to die on snow-filled streets. Alex Pretty and Renee Good. Or Minneapolis, I hear your voice singing through the bloody mist. We'll take our stand for this land and the stranger in our midst.
Streets of Minneapolis by Bruce Springsteen. He performed his song on Friday in Minneapolis at a concert organized by Tom Morello. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department's released an additional 3 million pages of documents related to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and what the DOJ, the Department of Justice, is calling the final release of Epstein files. But there are over 2.5 million more pages that remain unreleased. On Sunday, Meet the Press host Kristen Welker interviewed Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna of California, co-sponsor of the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
Has the Justice Department fully complied with the law, Congressman?
No, they haven't. They've released, at best, half the documents. But even those shock the conscience of this country. I mean, you have some of the most wealthy individuals, tech leaders, finance leaders, politicians, all implicated in some way, having emails about wanting to go to Epstein's island, knowing that Epstein was a pedophile. It's frankly one of the largest scandals, in my view, in our country's history. And there is a demand for elite accountability. But the survivors' lawyers that I've talked to have said that the survivors are still upset. They're upset that many of their names accidentally came out without redactions. And they want to make sure the rest of the files come out.
The New York Times reports the new files include 5,300 files containing more than 38,000 references to Donald Trump. First Lady Melania Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and other related words. Many of the references are news articles about Trump, but the new files also include an FBI document that summarizes allegations made against Trump by people who had called the FBI's Threat Operations Center tip line. The documents also reveal new details about Epstein's connections to the rich and powerful across the world. In one email, Elon Musk asked Epstein, quote, "What day night will be the wildest party on your island?" unquote. Virgin Islands founder Richard Branson sent Epstein an email in 2013 saying he wanted to see him again, quote, "as long as you bring your harem," unquote. Emails showed Trump's Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick arranged to visit Epstein's island in 2012, years after Lutnick had claimed he'd cut off ties with Epstein. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche said it's unlikely anyone else will be prosecuted. A group of Epstein survivors criticized how the DOJ had handled the release. In a statement, the survivors said, quote, "This latest release of Jeffrey Epstein files is being sold as transparency, but what it actually does is expose survivors. As survivors, we should never be the ones named, scrutinized, and re-traumatized, while Epstein's enablers continue to benefit from secrecy. This is a betrayal of the very people this process is supposed to serve," unquote. We're joined now by two guests, Vicki Ward, longtime investigative journalist, host and co-producer of the podcast series Chasing Elaine, The Untold Story of the Woman in Epstein's Shadow, which also became a TV series by the same name. Ghislaine Maxwell is expected to testify before Congress on February 9th. Eric Vidali is also with us. He's a partner and managing attorney of the Bloom Firm, which is a victims' rights law firm. He represents 11 of Jeffrey Epstein accusers. Let's start with you, Eric. Talk about what came out in these documents and what didn't. In fact, one of your survivors, the people that you represent, was named over 500 times?
That's absolutely correct, 538 times. And what's so baffling is this seems to be sort of the perfect storm between incompetency and an active cover-up. It's both, and it's so mind-boggling because they're withholding documents that they shouldn't be withholding, that the public deserves to see based on attorney-client privilege and some other very vague privileges. But on the other hand, they're showing documents that they shouldn't be showing because they contain unredacted names of survivors. 538 times is an outrageous amount of mistakes to expose a woman who was sexually trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein from Uzbekistan in 2009. And that is so significant because that is a year after Jeffrey Epstein got the sweetheart deal from Alex Acosta, which, again, not a lot of documents there explaining Alex Acosta's decision to ignore survivors and give Epstein this sweetheart deal.
I remember seeing her. I was very shocked in Washington when all the other survivors were there. Incredibly brave. She had decided just late the night before to present herself, right, mm-hmm. to stand in solidarity. She's from Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
But you spoke for her.
Yes, absolutely. I spoke for her because she's still been hesitant to become public. Some of the collective empowerment of the other survivors really empowered her to at least show up and show her face. And that was a really big moment for her. Remember, she was abused while Jeffrey Epstein was wearing an ankle bracelet from the Alex Acosta plea deal. So, I mean, it's really compelling. And now she wants to still remain private. She doesn't want her name out there in the grand, you know, national news. And 538 times the DOJ missed her name. And that is a name that was provided by my firm to the DOJ. There's just no excuse for that type of incompetency and that type of mistake.
And what about the people who are being protected? Not the survivors, clearly.
That's what's so mind-boggling about the whole thing is they're naming survivors, they're protecting potential predators. And the real issue here is there's just no oversight. And there's been motions for the court, and we're actually filing an amicus brief and some letters to the court on behalf of our clients to demand that a special master be appointed to review all of the materials and decide what should be privileged, what should be produced, what should be redacted, and what shouldn't. Because right now, the public, the survivors, all of us are forced to trust a Department of Justice, Trump's Department of Justice, that has done absolutely nothing to earn our trust.
Vicki Ward, what were you most struck by with the release of the millions of pages of files and the pages that weren't released?
Right. Well, just to Eric's point about your poor client, being trafficked to Epstein in 2009. I did read some interesting exchanges among, you know, redacted officials within the Justice Department. You know, in dated, they were dated 2011, and it was when Bradley Edwards and other of the attorneys who's, you know, represented so many survivors was pushing, arguing that it had been a breach of the Crime Victims Act, that this non-prosecution agreement had been done behind their backs without their knowledge. Yeah. And you see these unnamed Justice Department officials saying, well, whether or not we, you know, that deal was good or bad, we've got to dig in and protect ourselves. But there's almost, I mean, I was struck by that. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but it was whether or not that was a good, we sh- that w- whatever the content of that deal was, they knew.
Absolutely.
It was a really bad thing to have done.
There's reporting that Alex Acosta instructed his fellow prosecutors not to inform the victims of the special plea deal. That's a big deal. I was a prosecutor for like 6 months. I didn't care for it. But the one thing I learned in that 6 months is that when you do a plea deal, you inform the victims. So the fact that that's reported, that he did, that he instructed them not to inform the victims, that's pretty suspicious.
And just for people's memory, because this is a complicated story, back in 2007, what that plea deal was and the bravery of the Farmer sisters, Maria Farmer coming forward, over a decade before, and the number of young women, girls, children, who had been abused, and yet the deal that was
reached—it's re-victimizing. It's beyond a travesty of injustice. The one thing, you know, he was literally, many victims were ignored, and he was literally given like a slap on the wrist. One thing that is important to understand, though, that the one thing Alex Acosta did do is he did make him a registered sex offender in 2007, 2008. So that was public knowledge, and that brings some real questions to anyone that's been released in these new files. Anyone who is continuing to associate closely with Jeffrey Epstein after he became a publicly known registered sex offender, I think has some questions to answer.
Well, and to that, Amy, I will say, you know, as you know, I have a personal history on reporting this story, and I went through hell in 2002 with Epstein threatening me because I'd got to the Farmer sisters, and I found it nauseating to suddenly see this fax from Jeffrey Epstein to Graydon Carter bashing me and the questions I'd been asking of him and Ghislaine Maxwell about the pharmacists back in 2002.
Let's be clear, because we've talked about this in detail, but back in 2002, you were writing for Vanity Fair. You were asked to do a piece on this up-and-coming millionaire, billionaire Jeffrey Epstein, and then you found the story of the Farmer sisters.
Yes.
Epstein actually came into the offices of Vanity Fair.
Behind my back.
And you were about to have twins.
I was about to have twins. I was on bed rest. We were wrapping up the final sort of stages of fact-checking. The Farmer sisters were definitely in the piece and their allegations. But what I did not know was that Jeffrey Epstein had sent my boss this fax, casting all these absurd aspersions on me. And that obviously it was after that that the Farmer sisters and their allegations were cut. What I then found interesting, again, going back to what Eric was saying, that there were all these emails from all these guys after it was known that Jeffrey Epstein was a convicted sex offender. Even then, I found emails with another Vanity Fair reporter who's sadly dead, John Connolly, but ended up co-authoring a book with James Patterson, now my co-author, Filthy Rich. There are all sorts of correspondence.
It was called Filthy Rich.
Yes. There were all sorts of correspondence about John Connolly. And at one point, Epstein reaches out to Michael Wolff and says, shall we ask Graydon? In other words, Graydon Carter was part of the boys' club, at least in Epstein's mind, that part of the boys' club, along with Elon Musk and Steve Tisch and Howard Lutnick and Richard Branson and, you know,
Branson, who is the founder of Virgin Airways.
Yes, and, you know, Andrew Mountbatten. You know, we just see over and over again in these documents, this is just one big billionaire's boys' club that, you know, treated women like objects. I mean, this, you know, discussion of, I don't want to even talk about it on here, the discussion of their body part. I mean, you know, and you see Epstein writing let's not put this down on paper too much. I mean, he was aware of that. But I do want to mention one thing, which is, as you mentioned, Ghislaine Maxwell is supposed to testify before the House Oversight Committee virtually next Monday. And in her, and you know, I think we probably won't learn anything. I think she's going to plead the fifth. But in her habeas corpus filing as, that she's filed as part of her appeal, she does talk about 25 men with whom settlements were done, and she claims that they were done, they were pressured into doing these settlements because of the criminal proceedings hanging over her. I have always said that my sources have told me this, that there were a lot of civil settlements done behind the scenes with men who, and if those settlements had not been done, maybe they would be being criminally prosecuted.
When you say private settlements, you mean money settlements?
Yes.
With survivors?
Yes, with non-disclosure agreements.
And you're, I mean, you have 11, you represent 11 survivors, but the Uzbekistan survivor, the woman who came from Uzbekistan being promised a, what, a modeling deal, was, what, 19?
Right.
It wouldn't have happened to her if Jeffrey Epstein back in 2007.
Right. Absolutely. And that's what's so appalling about that deal is it did absolutely nothing to protect women from Jeffrey Epstein. That's the whole point of what a district attorney is supposed to do when they catch criminals. It's to stop them in their tracks and to protect the other potential victims. And that's the exact opposite what Alex Acosta and his team did. That's what's such a travesty, because had he not given him the, that sweetheart deal, had he not given the slap on the wrist, my client and many, many other women would have never met Jeffrey Epstein, would have never been trafficked, and their lives would be much, much different today. And that's the other such a frustrating thing about the documents releases. I'm not seeing anything. I haven't seen anything really explaining the prosecution agreements, the prosecutor's notes, what really the discussions, the emails, what went in to that deal that is such a suspicious and just really travesty of an injustice type of deal.
Well, you do see, what you do see, though, again, is the brotherhood at work. You do see how Alex Acosta was great buddies with Jay Lefkowitz, another of the lawyers on Jeffrey Epstein's team, that Epstein was very clever bringing in all the lawyers that he thought would be able to work, lawyers in the Justice Department, for whatever reason. Alex Acosta, once he left his position in government, went into private practice in the same firm as Jay Lefkowitz. I mean, this is how the world works, really tragically.
Finally, there are extreme allegations in these millions of pages of murder, of sexual assault. In one case, President Trump, it's talked about having raped a 13-year-old. But these are allegations, although there was a lawsuit brought by a young woman who that lawsuit was then taken away immediately.
Yeah, vanished, right. You're talking about Katie.
And
yeah,
these come through a tip line, of course.
Yes.
These all have to be investigated. But it looks like Blanche says the investigations are done.
Yeah,
that's what he says. But he's also withholding documents, apparently, due to ongoing investigations or something very vague about that. And again, that's why we need a special master, someone to oversee this other than the Department of Justice policing itself, because I don't believe the Department of Justice can be trusted to police itself when it comes to Jeffrey Epstein, because Jeffrey Epstein continues to be the only criminal I've ever, looked into who continues to get special treatment beyond the grave.
Well put.
We're going to continue to follow this. And, of course, the Ghislaine Maxwell testifying next Monday. I want to thank you both for being with us. Eric Vidali represents 11 Epstein survivors. And I want to thank Vicky Ward, a longtime investigative journalist, co-produced the podcast and TV series Chasing Ghislaine, The Untold Story of the Woman in Epstein's Shadow. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the raiding of polling places in Georgia, the raiding, FBI raid on the election office in Fulton County, Georgia. Stay with us.
Trump's federal thugs beat up on his face and his chest. Then we heard the gunshots and Alex Pretty lay in the snow dead. Their claim was self-defense, sir. Just don't believe your eyes. It's our blood and bones and these whistles and phones against Miller.
Streets of Minneapolis by Bruce Springsteen. He released the song last week and then played it in Minneapolis this weekend. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the FBI raid of an election office in Georgia's Fulton County last week, seeking computers and ballots related to the 2020 election. The raid came as President Trump continues to falsely claim his defeat in the 2020 election was a result of widespread voting fraud. For more, we go to Ari Berman, voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. His most recent piece, headlined "From Minnesota to Georgia, Trump's plans to interfere in the midterms are becoming more dangerous." Ari, talk about the significance of the Trump administration going after the blackest county election office in Georgia, and then Pam Bondi saying maybe they'll pull out the agents in Minnesota if they hand over voting rolls.
Yeah, we're seeing, Amy, a dramatic escalation of the administration's tactics to try to interfere in the 2026 midterm elections. The FBI raid in Fulton County represented the full weaponization of Trump's conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. The fact that they seized 700 boxes of ballots was incredibly disturbing and sets a chilling precedent for how Trump might try to interfere in the 2026 election to do similar kind of things, to challenge election results he doesn't like. If he's challenging a result from 6 years ago, you can imagine how they're going to try to challenge the result of the upcoming election should Trump's party lose. And then in Minnesota, you have ICE basically terrorizing a blue state and a blue city, and the Attorney General of the United States essentially extorting that place to hand over voter rolls to the Department of Justice. So what I really want your listeners to understand is that this is now a multi-front concerted effort to try to interfere in the midterm elections that's taking place in a number of different ways from Georgia to Minnesota and beyond.
What happens to the computers and the data they took out of the Georgia election office?
Well, that's a very good question. It's one of the many unanswered questions about this raid in Fulton County. The FBI now has it. Who are they going to share it with? What are they going to do? Who's going to supervise this process? All of these records were under seal, and now they're in the hands of the Trump administration. And one of the biggest unanswered questions is why Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, was there, because she is prohibited by law from participating in domestic law enforcement activity. So that's a giant red flag right there. Tulsi Gabbard shouldn't have been anywhere near that operation, anywhere near those ballots. And it seems to me like they're setting up to do something crazy, like saying, now we have the proof, we have the ballots. Now we know Venezuela interfered in the election, or Iran interfered in the election. And this is as much about, as I said, the 2020 election as it is about the next election. So they're going to lie, continue lying about the 2020 election, so that then they can lie about the next election and try to interfere in a lot of different ways.
And then can you talk about the voting rolls of Minnesota?
Yeah, so what the Justice Department is trying to do is they're trying to get the voter rolls, not just of Minnesota, but of 24 states overall. And they want this data so they can have the first ever national database of all registered voters in the country. And that has a lot of problems with it. There's privacy problems. You're talking about sensitive information like driver's license, social security numbers, party history. There's security risks. It's a lot easier to hack.
15 seconds, Ari.
It's a lot easier to hack a massive database. But ultimately, what they want to do is they want to lie about voter fraud, remove people from the rolls, and challenge election outcomes. And the attempt to take voter rolls is just a larger part of Trump's scheme to try to rig the midterms.
Trump supports states' rights, except when it comes to voting rights. Ari Berman, voting rights correspondent.
He supports
for Mother
states'
Jones
rights, except
Magazine.
When
we'll
over.
Link to your article. That does it for our show. I'll be in Santa Barbara this weekend for the International Film Festival. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Please enjoy 30 seconds of nature, brought to you by Ducks Unlimited Canada. Learn how you can experience nature in your community at ducks.ca.